This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.
A woman may read A Game of Thrones.
A woman may start a podcast.
Two women may host Podcasters Landing, the show devoted to the entire A Song of Ice and Fire series.
Two women may cover three chapters each week, followed by history and friendship lessons.
A listener may sit and tune in.
A woman may use adult language.
A woman may reveal spoilers.
A listener may support the show on our Patreon page at patreon.com/Sophia Mayer Studios, all under case.
A woman welcomes a listener to Podcaster's Landing.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Nat.
And today we are covering chapters 4, 5, and 6 of Game of Thrones, which is Daenerys, Eddard, and Jon. In these chapters, it's keeping up with the Targaryens.
Oh, dear.
And Ned is guilt-tripped into taking a job he doesn't want.
Haven't we all, Amy?
Yeah. And I felt so bad for John. Poor little John. John the bastard.
I know. He never gets anything.
Yeah, makes me sad rereading it all over again. But first, let us dive into Daenerys. So, of course, just typical reminder of, oh yeah, Viserys is a scum bucket.
Oh, absolutely. He is just gross from the get-go. He's just awful. I don't know. It just seems like really slimy from the beginning, you know. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just thinking, like, they were both in exile. So how did they end up so different in personality? And the only thing is that, you know, Daenerys was an infant, like just born when they fled. And mm-hmm. at first I thought Viserys was 5 years old, but apparently he was 8 years old. So he has. So I think it's, again, was the term in political science the notion of relative loss.
Mm-hmm.
The notion of, you know, Dany doesn't have that sense of, you know, loss that Viserys has. So naturally that's had substantially different impacts on them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, still, he's sort of like retreated into himself, Viserys, because you would think, given his life in exile, that would have forced him to face reality a little more. But instead, he's just cocooned himself in this delusion of grandeur.
Yeah, I think, well, to your first point, where you asked how did they turn out so different, I think it's a lot of, you know, she has not known anything but that sort of behavior from him. And because he is abusive and controlling, all she can do is be mild-mannered and just go with the flow and try not to wake the dragon, which is ridiculous. But yeah, he is deluded, completely deluded, just, you know, with the hired knives and mm-hmm. and just saying that he's gonna go and kill the usurper, which we don't know who that is yet, even though we might have a hint, you know. So it's like, oh, he's gonna kill the usurper and the Kingslayer, and it's mm-hmm. like, even though he's never killed anyone before in his life.
Right. It's so, yeah, they are essentially guests of Maester Illyrio, who is basically a merchant prince of mm-hmm. Pentos. And I couldn't help but thinking, but Illyrio made me think of like the really wealthy, like Greek, Armenian, and Jewish merchants in the Ottoman Empire way back when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with all the silks and...
Yeah, with all the silks.
And jewelers.
Because I remember at a later date, like Tyrion refers to Illyrio as like a cheesemonger. So I'm like, so they didn't describe... Mm. Like you said, he was a merchant of all types of things, but they never mentioned cheese.
Yeah, yeah. I think he was, what did you say, like food?
Spices.
Yeah, say spices, gemstones, dragon bone, and other less savory things. Mm. Maybe that's cheese.
But cheese is delicious. How is cheese less savory?
Well, you know, if you've got a bad stomach, it can give you the shits. I don't know. Oh, dear. Oh, well.
Yeah. And it's, again, just it's interesting to think of Magister Illyrio's motivations at this point, but they describe mm-hmm. it in a way that makes sense, that in the beginning mm-hmm. when they were deposed, people were really gracious and welcoming to them because they didn't know how long this was going to last in terms of, you know, them being off the throne and stuff. But yeah. So people wanted to ingratiate themselves with Viserys. But then as time wore on and on and on and realized, okay, that the usurper is, you know, this is the new king. And like, he doesn't have an army. He doesn't have followers. He doesn't have supporters. So just getting more and more mocked and ridiculed. So just with that context of it's been 15 years. And the idea of, you know, why is Illyrio specifically choosing to invest in the Targaryens?
Yeah, it's a very weird situation that they find themselves in. I mean, you just don't know. I was thinking, oh, maybe, you know, he is sort of kind, but also has sort of a, you know, a horse in the race. If they do, you know, come to power, then he has a leg up. But yeah, I'm not entirely sure why they are there, unless it is to gain favor. Mm-hmm. Well, now you can see that it's to gain favor with Khal Drogo.
Yes, this is true. And, you know, there has been theories that have been thrown back and forth if whether Illyrio is not so much investing in Viserys because he can see Viserys for what he is and is rather investing in Dany, given mm-hmm. to the wedding present we know he's going to give her.
Yeah, yeah, so, absolutely.
But yeah, again, it's hard to tell just whether he's investing in the family or the natural quote-unquote option, Viserys, because he's the man, or whether he mm-hmm. specifically noticed something in Dany that's just like, oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. I think he may see her as very resilient. You can see, you know, that she has been through a lot just, you know, by the reaction that she has, like, from the get-go about the soft fabric, that it scared her because she's so suspicious of everything, and she has never had, like, such nice things that she can remember. So maybe he sees, you know, there's a sort of resilience that goes behind everything True. That they went through.
Yeah. And again, regardless of his, like, feelings to Viserys' feelings of wanting to get the throne back, it's kind of, you know, Dany is, you know, significantly younger than Viserys, and yet she mm-hmm. already knows, again, like, to be suspicious of people. And like, Viserys, like, being on the run, he should be well versed in this stuff by now, but he's not. And I'm just like, who has pampered him? Because they've only been with Illyrio for a year. Who has pampered him? Like, it just blows my mind, this level of delusion that, like, again, it's not like he had one benefactor who's been taking care of him for 15 years. They've been hopping mm-hmm. place to place. And again, as years go by, losing favor and the various aristocracy of mm-hmm. Braavos and the Free Cities are losing patience. Okay, this is not a worthy investment. So,
yeah. And losing yeah. their riches as well. They had to give everything away, isn't it? So yeah. All their jewelry and now, like, the little money that they made from their mother's crown is also gone. Mm-hmm. So they don't have a leg to stand upon. But I think Viserys might have had some sort of like Joffrey syndrome, where yeah, you know he has seen that, you know, for a very long time of his life. Well, for 8 years of his life, he has been in luxury and, you know, mm-hmm. in power. And then that just never left him, really.
Yeah. And also there's the notion of, is it a purely not psychological, like being really dumb and adapting to its circumstances? It could just be a legit, he cannot let go neurologically because he's touched in the head because of incest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there is that too. Yeah, that he.
Think about.
Yeah, he had got the touch of the madness that we don't know yet, but mm-hmm. it does run in the family. So yeah.
Yeah. So they're preparing to go out and meet Khal Drogo, who is going, who is Daenerys's betrothed.
Yes, yes. And
how did Illyrio strike this deal again? Because they've lost, they sold their mom's crown. Like Khal Drogo, what is Khal Drogo getting out of this deal?
A young bride, and I guess the thirst for war, because I think that's the promise for war, and I don't know, maybe that's what he...
If it was normal war, like, within Essos that they're used to, like, that's one thing, but they... But it's shown, you know, later that Khal Drogo is hesitant, and then only when the assassination attempt is made that he's like, oh, you're gonna mess with my wife? I will go over the now see you, and I will fuck up a bitch.
Yeah. Oh, wasn't there a mention, is it in here, or is it in the TV show, like, that that Khal Drogo was given like a bunch of horses in exchange for Daenerys as well?
Oh, is that possible? I don't know. That would make more sense if Magister Illyrio was able to wrangle that.
Yeah, but then again, what is his, you know?
Yeah, maybe. So yeah, maybe Illyrio is backing a sort of dowry of things that aren't, you know, directly itemized to us as the readers. Yeah,
for sure. What I think is really interesting is the fact that it's the collar that when Dany's getting dressed, she gets given a collar that is from Valyria. And then earlier on, the servant girl was talking about how even Khal Drogo's slaves had collars. Yeah, gold collars. And then it's just like Viserys and Dany had to sell everything that they had to survive. And now that the only thing left is for Viserys to sell Dany, which is so sad.
Yes, this is so sad. Of course, brings forth the, again, notion of arranged marriages, because this is literally how women were treated, like, literally as means to put their bloodline in other bloodlines so that other people won't go to war with them.
Yeah, exactly. It's disgusting and sad.
Daenerys, well, we get, of course, the sort of Sir Willem Dary was the guy who snatched, you know, Daenerys and Viserys and took them over. And, of course, she always goes back to the big house with a red door.
Yeah, yeah, that she kind of perceived that as a bit of a home, isn't it? And
yeah, with a cute little lemon tree in her outside her window.
Yeah, and she still wishes she had that. And it's, bless her, it's awful.
Yeah, and she's sad that the minute that guy died, the servants just, like, stripped the place.
And kicked them out. It's just, yeah, just no loyalties, man, to anyone. In this bit as well, where she's telling them, she's telling us, the readers, like, you know, what the story was, what happened to her family. It's the first time that we see the Starks sort of painted in a bad light, because they have been described together with the Lannister. So it was saying her brother Rhaegar battling the usurper in the bloody waters of the Trident and dying for the woman he loved, the sack of King's Landing by the ones Viserys called the usurper's dog, the Lords Lannister and Stark. And then saying immediately after that Rhaegar's heir was stripped from, you know, his mother's breast and then killed. And it's kind of like, did the Starks did that? And it's just kind of like, okay.
With the exception of the Dornish, everyone else is considered to be kind of traitors who went along with the usurper, with Robert's rebellion. And again, the Dornish hands were tied because obviously the princess was Rhaegar's wife. So
yeah,
apart from the Dornish, I think they just lump everyone else in the same, you know, pile.
Yeah, in the same boat, apart from, you know, the Greyjoys, which makes you think, what is Theon actually doing? Which will be answered in the next next couple of chapters anyway. But, you know, they were saying that they are still people, they're still banners that are still loyal to the Targaryens. The Greyjoys were one of them. And it makes you think, why is Theon the ward? Why is Theon Ned's ward?
Yeah. And then there was just, again, Danny does not, you know, kind of explain, well, again, like the Starks, you know, were pissed off because Lyanna was taken. So, like, she doesn't go into anything about why. Yeah, again, why particularly the Starks or the Baratheons might not be too happy with the Targaryens. But anyway.
Yeah, well, she doesn't understand. Maybe she wasn't even told because...
Yeah, it's possible. And Viserys's, you know, screwed up mind. He's just like, you know, why should we go to a war over a woman? He's a prince. He can have whatever woman he wants. Like, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And he already had a woman, so...
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
Yeah, so Daenerys, again, this whole thing is very surreal. This notion with Khal Drogo, because she always thought that she would just have to marry Viserys, because that's what the Targaryens do. Just like the ancient Egyptians would marry their brothers and sisters to keep the line of the pharaoh pure.
Yes, and British royalty too.
even their siblings or just their cousins?
Cousins. Yeah. I guess not their siblings.
Because... I personally think it's funny, not that I'm advocating for incest or anything, but it's just, again, the fact that cousins are considered acceptable partners and, in fact, good partners, you know, in the way to keep money in the family. They all have the same grandparents. But then brother and sister, it's like, how dare you?
So I know.
Like, what is the real difference between having the same parents over having the same grandparents?
Maybe there is a scientific reason why.
Well, not... Well, I think they were so obsessed with keeping the money and power within a particular group of people that they justified it to themselves to allow marrying cousins. They couldn't do it for siblings, but they could do it for cousins.
Yeah, yeah, that is true. Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Philip were also cousins. I think they were second or third cousins.
Okay, that's removing it a little bit, but... Mm. Yeah, and again, Queen Victoria, the love of her life, Prince Albert, was her first cousin.
Yes, for sure. Yeah. Oh, no.
Anyway, so this is a new idea for Dany, because Viserys is, and you know, Viserys is trying to be all like, you know, manly about like, I can, you know, I can sell you off and stuff. But probably in his mind, like, this is a really, really big concession for Viserys to give up Dany, even though he doesn't act like it in any way and still tries to control her and stuff. But just even in name, just saying, you know, in terms of, again, the tradition, and he's been deluded by that tradition of like the Targaryens are above everyone else and now we're going to marry outside.
Yeah, so. It's letting his ambition go before bloodline, isn't it? I mean, not that I'm complaining much that she didn't end up with him, but it is, you know, that shows, because, well, it does say here that because their mother died after giving birth to Dany, he never really liked her. He never really forgiven her for that. So I guess it's just like, yeah, whatever.
So, like, are you sure Khal Drogo likes his women this young? She has had her blood. She is old enough for the Khal. And again, just the really gross thing that that womanhood and maturity and consent and all these things are determined by whether you have your period or not.
I know. It's the poor thing. It's just like she's not even properly matured yet. You know, she hasn't... You know, not to be too crude, but like her breasts haven't even developed yet. But God, yeah, you know,
because those can those specific things, that time gap can vary from woman to woman. There are you know, girls who get their period as early as 11. You know, I was sort of later. I don't know if this TMI, but I got mine at 14, and then but even with that, I didn't quote unquote develop a womanly shape until I was like 17 or 18.
Yep.
So
Yeah, and I was, sort of the opposite. I developed before I got my period. So, yeah, it depends. But from what they are describing here, she's too skinny, and he's like, oh, stand up tall and let him see that you have boobs. And it the poor thing, she's just like, she has no idea what's going on.
Yes, they carry her to a, you know, kind of palace that they sort of, I guess, rent out to the Khals, and you know, it's basically easy to keep the Dothraki from like attacking them or invading them, because they just give them a bunch of goods.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's what I found curious about their description of the Dothraki is that, so they are described as, well, they're labeled as barbarians, and sort of there's a sense of that they're savages. But at no point in this chapter, it mentions what they have done to be labeled as such. And in fact, when they do walk into the palace that Khal Drogo is in, it's sort of the opposite. He's like hosting a bunch of powerful people. There's gold like in his braids, and he's wearing, you know, gold, and like all of his blood riders are wearing, you know, gold. And so it's just, it's that misconception that anything different is dangerous.
Yeah, because I would put money on that. Even if the Dothraki culture wasn't a like warmongering people, mm-hmm. and like super brutal in that way, just the fact that they are nomadic, that is enough to get them labeled as barbaric and savage. And I heard one documentary, I think for the show, talking about the Dothraki, they said it's sort of hybrid of the Mongols and Native Americans, specifically Native Americans of the Great Plains, like the Lakota in North and South Dakota.
Yeah.
Because they were very, you know, a Native American culture where the horse was obviously important.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also, there's also a hint of like that they're stupid as well, just because of what Illyrio said. He said, it is not that we fear these barbarians. The Lord of Light will hold our city walls against a million Dothraki, or so the Red Priests promise. Yet why take chances when their friendship comes so cheap? It's just like, well, they're dumb because they haven't accepted much. So.
Yeah, and it's, what was it? What was I going to think? It reminded me of something. Now I lost it. It'll come back to me. Anyway, so yeah, they go into, you know, the palace, and we first get our glimpse of Jorah Mormont.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And in reading these books, if there's one thing I'm disappointed in, as you know, in the TV show, they make Jorah Mormont very sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like that actor, Ian Glenn. And yeah, so, like, Jorah was one of my favorites. And then having to reconcile that this Jorah is not always like that.
No, he seems a bit cold, a bit standoffish, isn't it? And because on the show as well, he's not Khal Drogo's blood rider, but on the book, he is. He has, like, three different blood riders. One is Dothraki, the other one is, what is he? Tyrosh. Yeah, and then there's Ser Jorah Mormont, who is a knight.
Yeah. So we get our first, and you know, Danny's just, you know, naturally curious by him. It's like, oh, this is technically what my countrymen, you know, look like. And again, it's this really weird thing because the Targaryens themselves originate from Valyria, and we're only and you've only been in Westeros 100 years.
Yeah,
and so they're in a position where they're outsiders to Westeros, and by now they're outsiders to Essos.
Yeah, yeah, they have no land. They have no idea, and I guess like she's curious about him as well because she probably has seen people that look like Khal Drogo and you know the people around Khal Drogo, but she has never seen someone that wears leather and chain mail and carries a sword. So for her, it's just very fascinating. She looks at him with like a childlike curiosity, which bless her, she is a child.
Khal Drogo. Just trying to think anything more to say. Just that she, it's sad that like the way she describes it, he was younger than she thought, no more than 30. Like the fact that, you know, she's like 13 and he's 30, and like in like I kind of read the subtext as a sigh of relief to her. It's like, okay, he's not like a disgusting old man.
Yeah, I think maybe she thought he would look like Illyrio, like big and fat and full of jewels and just like, but he is sort of, at the very least, he'll be able to protect her because he is a powerful warlord, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and his hair is so long because he has never, ever been defeated. Which, again, the hair thing also reminds me of Native Americans, because an example of one of many the traumatic things they did to Native American children when they were, like, forced into those, like, boarding schools to be, like, quote-unquote civilized, is that they would cut their hair.
That's awful. That's disgusting. That is so sad. It's just, what does that have to do with anything, you know?
They're not allowed to have a non-white culture, that's what.
Yeah, it was the same in Brazil, to be fair. Yeah.
Again, it's so sad that Danny's just like, I don't want to be his queen. I want to go home.
Yeah. And Viserys is like, that's what we're going to get with him. So, and then does he say that in this bit? Like, I would let
his Khalasar and their horses and everyone's like, screw you if that's what it took. And again, it's just, again, the notion of home, because she was literally thinking just go back to Illyrio's mansion or even just the house with the red door. Like, again, home is not the same thing to her.
Yeah, she's very lost. She, you know, for her, I think home is just very temporary and is a shelter. But for him, it's like, no, the home is where I live for 8 years of my life. And that's where we're going to go. And screw whatever you think and whatever you want. And... do you think as well that he's just so easily triggered? He just gets so angry all the time. Just, you can't say.
I think anger in his position, like, anger is often the external form of fear, anxiety, frustration. In a way, anger is more powerful and appears more powerful, and it intimidates people. And so I think he relies excessively on anger, because he doesn't have any more social capital.
Yeah, for sure. Especially when the eunuch went to check their carriage to see if they were, you know, if they were okay and everything. And then he was like gripping the hilt of his sword, but he looked terrified. And then he said something like, hang on, what did he say?
Like, don't you know who
insolent.
I am?
Yeah, insolent eunuch. That's what he said.
It would have been interesting to see exactly how Viserys perceived his life in King's Landing in Westeros and how it related to, you know, with Rhaegar. Because like, he must have been a significantly spoiled brat for this to endure through these 15 years of exile. My impression of their mother was that she wasn't a bad or mean like woman, was just a victim of, you know, her husband. So
The misogyny, because he wasn't even the firstborn, so he wasn't even going to get anything apart from some sort of kingdom, so he didn't even
to be king. Anyway, yep, and that is Keeping Up with the Targaryens in Pentos. The next thing we have is Eddard. Everyone is all up in arms because the king has arrived.
The king and about 300 people with him. Can you imagine that just coming into your house?
First of all, my condo would not even handle the king's family, let alone his entourage.
It's hectic. It's madness. It's just, I don't even know how they can cope. Where are they going to put? I know it's a castle, but Jesus Christ.
Like, where are they going to keep everyone? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why, you know, they claim that, oh, women didn't do anything. But, you know, not, again, like, being a housewife, especially being a lady of a manor, I'm just thinking of all these logistics of the food, of the lodgings, of the fire. Exactly. Make sure there's enough coal and wood for the fires. And, like, everything and all that emotional labor to, like, take care of a household, and especially one of this size.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, it's like she is a project manager.
Yeah,
you know, having to coordinate how everything is going to be and just stressing about how much food there is. And yeah, it's just a nightmare.
Yeah, and the minute King Robert gets down and like you've not changed at all. Would that Ned had been able to say the same, because he's just so fat now and just this, you know.
I know. He said that, you know, he was, what did he say? He was like a maiden's dream or something.
Yeah, like he was the heartthrob back in the day when he was smashing Rhaegar Targaryen's skull with his warhammer.
Yeah, he was like tall. He was like a giant. And it honestly got me a bit hot and bothered. I was like, ooh. I wonder, I would love to see some sort of like, you know, Robert's Rebellion like show, just to see how he looked like. But yeah, he just seems like gross now.
Yeah, a lecherous black-bearded Santa Claus.
Yes, yeah, just crude and disgusting.
Yeah, and it's, I don't know what, like, I, in this position, you know, we get from Ned's perspective, you know, obviously the, you know, the queen coming in, and Ned, Robert's like, you know, where's your crypt? I want to pay my respects. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I don't feel like Cersei is unreasonable for saying, for it's been 15 years. Like, they've already done so many other things to like hurt each other at this point, and not caring about their marriage in the slightest. So I think at least for Cersei, it wasn't so much the emotional as it was like, you know, in front of all these people, you're going to go to the crypts instead of like, you know, help your family get settled in.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like she just gets slapped in the face, especially because we don't know much about her anyway. It's just like she just gets slapped in the face. That's sort of the reaction that I feel when she says, but the thing is, she was a bit crude when she said the dead can wait. I understand her point. So she doesn't hold her tongue, but
I wish Ned would have just said like, I don't know, or at least thought a little something, but all he says is, you know, Ned loved Robert for that. And it's like, you know, forget the beautiful queen that's just sitting right in front of you, who's now your guest, you know,
that has been traveling for months now.
Yeah, it's complicated, and both neither Robert nor Cersei, you know, do anything to restrain their worser impulses when it comes to each other.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's just a bit, it's just uncomfortable.
It's very uncomfortable. And then, so they go down to the crypt together, and I didn't think of this when I was first reading it, because, you know, I was kind of more thinking about, is this going to be exactly like the show, which it very much was. This rereading, I'm thinking, was this kind of deliberate on Robert's part? Was he trying to, you know, emotionally manipulate Ned to ask this, I want you to be the hand of the king, in the crypt next to his sister's grave, and extorting, you know, all that sort of affection, you know, that I see how much I loved your sister, and, you know, thing, and how much I still love her, and things like that, to like guilt trip Ned more into saying yes? Because I what did you think?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly it. He's just like, Ned does say in this chapter that they were meant to be brothers, so that memory strikes him when they are down in the crypt, and then Robert goes and says, you know, I was going to wait, but, you know, let me tell you this right now. And, you know, Ned knows that it's coming, and he's just trying to stall, because I've never seen him, like, speak so much. And then in that bit where he's just like, oh, you could, you know, you could do this and you could do that. And he's like, shut up, basically.
Yeah. But it was very sweet of Robert just to be like, you know, should be under like a fruit tree with the sun and clouds over her, and like things like that. And I was like,
yeah.
And it made me think about, from what we know, was it the R plus L equals J conspiracy? Like, that was pretty well established and kind of more or less agreed upon by everyone, even before the Game of Thrones decided to go that route.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking, did Robert really, really love Lyanna, or did he love this idea of her?
The idea of her. Definitely. Yeah. You know, she's his best friend's sister. She is available. So why not? You know, mm-hmm. I don't think he was just like, oh, she's just there, so let me have her. But it's kind of like he romanticized this thing in his head, I think. That it's just like, oh, she's a young girl. It would just make sense. Like, we are two powerful families. It just makes sense.
Yeah, and it's like, or maybe he genuinely, because, again, from what we saw in the show a little bit, she was a little, you know, headstrong and mm-hmm. things like that. So maybe there were qualities in her that he genuinely admired, but just she just never reciprocated them. And mm-hmm. in my head canon, I sometimes wonder, did Robert know that Lyanna went with Rhaegar willingly and still started the war because he was so, like, you know, pride wounded mm-hmm. and things like that?
I don't think so. I think he was just so blinded for the fact that, like, oh yeah, I love this woman, of course she loves me, and then it comes in like this guy who is such a villain and took her and just did whatever with her and, like, raped her and killed her, that he's just like, in his head, he doesn't think, oh, it was her choice to go with
him. Because powerful men are not used to mm-hmm. viewing women as having their own minds.
Exactly, that's exactly it.
Yeah, she deserved more than darkness. She was a Stark of Winterfell, Ned said quietly. Mm-hmm. This is her place.
Yeah, yeah. It's really sad when he says she wanted to come home to rest beside Brandon and father. I was with her when she died. That is just really sad. Like, you can see where his sadness comes from, because, like, he lost basically his whole family, apart from Benjen, mm-hmm. in a matter of months because of the Targaryens.
Yeah. And then they go on to talk about, you know, Jon Arryn, he's died, mm-hmm. and talking about, like, little Robin, who mm-hmm. Lysa has absconded with him back to the Eyrie. And they go on to say that Tywin Lannister agreed to have Robin as a ward in Casterly Rock.
Yeah.
And this was unprecedented, because it's like Tywin and Casterly Rock usually doesn't take any wards ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I'm wondering what the reasoning was behind that.
I think because, aren't they quite a young, like, fancy family? Fancy family, look at me, I'm so studied. Aren't they quite young to power? Because they went and, like, took some,
Or the Arryns?
No, the Lannisters. They took, because there is that song that is about the family that they completely destroyed just to take.
Oh, Reigns of Castamere. That's my favorite.
Yeah. So they went and took the Castamere's, like, home. So I think that they're still sort of, we are fine. We don't need to take anyone. Like, you know, only Lannisters.
Yeah, like,
need to know how to fight.
Like, they were always one of the most wealthiest because of the gold they in their mines and, like, their region of Westeros, but they are still new, again, to being part of the royal family, mm-hmm. you know, of the usurper king. So, and then Ned says, you know, he could come up here with, you know, to Winterfell with, like, Bran, and Robert's like, no, like, to get take mm-hmm. it away, that would be such an insult, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, what I like about this, like, Ned is so triggered about the Lannisters. Like, he is, like, he takes it so serious that they joined, like, at the last minute that, and then what he says is, like, Ned will sooner entrust a child to a pit of vipers than to Lord Tywin.
Yeah, it's, there is this notion of, you know, loyalty to a fault, where it's mm-hmm. better to be truly loyal to someone who is maybe doing wrong
mm-hmm.
than it is to, like, oh, this person has gone insane, or this person has become corrupt. Like, I shouldn't be loyal to them anymore. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's hard for us to understand in the modern world, but yeah, in the sense of everyone hated King Aerys, but instead of thanking Jaime for it, they despised mm-hmm. him for it.
Yeah, calling him Kingslayer. I think that's what Jon says. They call, you know, his they call him Sir Jaime Lannister to his face, and behind his back they call him the Kingslayer. Like, obviously people hate being ruled by people that they can't appoint. Mm-hmm. So I don't think they will ever be happy, even if, like, replacing one with the other.
Yeah. And there is a little bit of foreshadowing where, you know, they go down to the crypts and there are, like, several, like, empty spaces waiting for them, him and his children. And he didn't want to think about that. So.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. When, God, how many? How many of them died? It's pretty sad. I cherish these moments in the beginning with Starks because I do like them.
Yep. So it's like, I want to name you Hand of the King. I'm not worthy of such an honor.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I have a son, you have a daughter. We'll join them together. And he's like, what?
Yeah, but Sansa is my baby. She's like, please don't. Please don't do this to me.
Again, it's the notion of, again, Robert's personal motivations, because in some ways he's being very honest, or at least hiding behind, like, what's good for the realm, because it's like, I can't do any of this, you know, rule a kingdom, you know, taking a throne is easier than sitting on it. And so now Jon Arryn, who was probably keeping things somewhat organized, that's gone. And so he's bringing Ned because he understands. Like, it's, again, he's bringing Ned because Ned is the smart, sensible one and will do the job well and tell him the truth to his face. But that's the exact reason why Ned falls out with him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, first of all, Ned just doesn't want it. He has this whole, you know, bit that says the Hand of the King was the second most powerful man in the Seven Kingdoms. He spoke with the king's voice, commanded the king's armies, drafted the king's laws. At times, he even sat upon the Iron Throne to dispense the king's justice when the king was absent or sick or otherwise indisposed. Robert was offering him a responsibility as large as the realm itself. It was the last thing in the world he wanted. He's just like, he's not comfortable with that amount of power, especially because earlier on, when he was looking at his brother and his dad, and he was like, well, my brother was meant to be the Lord of Winterfell, not me. So I don't think he feels comfortable in that position. Yes,
it's a little bit of imposter syndrome. You're right. Mm-hmm. And again, we're supposed to set this up as, you know, Ned's character of, he has no ambition beyond, like, he's a lord. He has plenty of power, but again, compared to the South and all the luxuries of the South, you know, the North is kind of looked down upon as having, you know, lesser, you know, resources and things like that. But
he just really doesn't want it. He doesn't, you know, and in fact, you know, you see throughout the whole chapter that he's always been following protocol with Robert, calling him your grace, even though they've been friends for years, you know, and he helped Robert take the throne and they've been through so much together. And this is the first time that he breaks protocol to be like, can I discuss it with my wife before I give you an answer? So it is kind of going against what...
Him directly being the Lord Paramount of the North, like, taking him away from the North, like, who the hell is going to do his Northern jobs?
Yeah, yeah, his little child.
Like, Rob?
Yeah.
That's exactly what ends up happening, but there's the... Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I feel really sorry for him. He just like feels tired, you know, between the rock.
I just want to stay in my castle.
Leave me alone.
In the snow, away from everybody. Like,
yeah, that's why,
how,
like,
I feel nil right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hide in my library home office, away from COVID, away from Delta variant.
Absolutely, it's just like, you know, I think isolation is just, like, very much Stark vibes, and I love it. I love it. Oh yeah, and in this chapter as well, it gives us the answer that, you know, why is Theon there? And it's because his father rose against the throne and declared himself the king of the Iron Islands, and as punishment, they went and took his son.
Yeah, because actually, like, the whole Seven Kingdoms being all together, like, that's not the relative norm for Westeros. They only were brought together under the fear of dragons, and with dragons, it's like, screw this.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like, well, if one man can take the Iron Throne, then this bit is mine, and that's it. But then they were just like, absolutely not. I think the fuck not. That's exactly what Robert said.
And that's the end of Ned's chapter, and we move on to John. Yes, you love John so much.
My baby John.
Yeah. He is not at the high table with his family. He's out down at one of the benches with the squires. And in a way, like, it shows the resilience of John is obviously we're shown in this chapter elements of his resentment and his, you know, observation and discontent with being treated differently. But he also, it's not just trying to, like, lie to himself, but he's genuinely trying to see the benefits of, you know, I'm not at the high tables, therefore I can be as rowdy as I want, I can drink whatever I want, I can have my dire wolf under the table, I can do all of these things because I'm not there.
Absolutely. He's just very understanding. It's just like, in this point in this chapter shows he's, you know, he's very mature. And but it you do feel kind of bad for him, because he is sort of, even though he's like, it, you know, living life, it's just, you know, it, I think he describes here that there was, like, you know, some people playing music, but he couldn't even hear because he was so far away.
Right. Yep. And then, you know, he, little cute ghost with his chicken, and the dog tries to come and take it. But Ghost is just like, don't even think about it.
Yeah. It just, you can see, like, this description very well of how the dog reacts. And it's very much, like, silent and waiting to see what's going to do. Like, very calculating. Very much John. I feel that they are very much, because, like, throughout this chapter, it's very much John observing everything and, like, being very intuitive about things. And, you know, even though Ghost was a puppy, he was just like, let me just stare at this dog and see what she's going to do. And then if I need to, I will just scare the shit out of her. And she's going to go away. He's just like, it's very observant, very, you know, very much astute to everything.
Eventually, you know, the Starks and the Lannisters pass by John's table, you know, as they were coming into the Great Hall. And I'm just thinking, obviously, we got a little bit of the Lannisters, you know, it was more in Eddard's chapter, but it was more about Robert, obviously. But here, I think, is the first time we get the real description of the Lannisters. And I think it's very poignant that we get this, like, detailed description, not from one of the quote-unquote true-born Starks, but from Jon. With that social distance, if you will, because even John can see, like, he could see past the smile on Queen Cersei's lips.
It's a good point of view that we're seeing it from John's side, because he's an outsider and we are outsiders to this whole situation, so it is giving us that overview of what exactly is happening. What I think is so fun that he says because Rob was escorting Marcella on his arm, and Marcella's all like, don't eye at him, and then he said he decided she was insipid. Rob didn't even have the sense to realize how stupid she was. He was grinning like a fool. It just,
well, wasn't Rob just as insipid at this point?
Yeah, he is. He just, like, has no idea what's going on, which shows the comparison between the two of them, how, like, Rob's just happy-go-lucky, doesn't have any idea of what the fuck's going on, and then John's very much, like, constant vigilance.
Like Mad-Eye Moody.
Exactly. But, you know, in this, like, procession, that's what I call the procession of, like, everyone coming in, first of all, like, Rickon just runs to John and it's the cutest thing. He's just he doesn't understand that like John is not with them. He just runs to John just being like, hello.
Yeah, and then, it's like trying to beckon the flower girl down the aisle at a wedding.
Yeah, exactly. And then there's also like fucking Theon is walking with the family. It's like that's a slap in the face.
Mm-hmm. Because that it's like hostage ward has more status than I do.
Exactly, like you took this boy as hostage, and so he doesn't offend the family, the royal family, but like John will offend the family, please. And that's like why I don't like Catelyn. It says here because like it's just like it doesn't seem like they have the best relationship. Like John just said, like
full well Robert would not have cared.
Yeah, only, no, he doesn't.
Only
give a shit.
Only Cersei, not even. Tyrion and not even Jaime would care. Only Cersei would care.
Yeah, and like I don't think no one cares. I think no one cares what she thinks, to be honest.
Yeah,
she's just there as decoration. That's what it looks like anyway to me. So it's just like it's just stupid. Like it's the way that
I think. Yeah, in a way, Catelyn is using it as an excuse to dismiss him in a way she wouldn't be able to.
Yeah, otherwise. Exactly.
That Ned wouldn't allow otherwise.
Yeah, you know that, she put it that way because, you know, the last thing that Ned wants to do is offend, you know, his friend and his king. So that's why she put it that way. But it's not like, oh, I don't want this kid here. But I think it's like you can see that they don't have like the best relationship just from the fact that Jon says to Benjen, Lady Stark thought it might give insult to the royal family to see the bastard among them.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that says like Lady Stark, not like Catelyn.
Yeah, Mama Kate.
Yeah.
Yeah, but we get Benjen, and I'm just wondering what happened. I wonder if there was an older sibling apart from, basically, if Ned wasn't bound to become the Lord of Winterfell and had that duty, would he have run off to the Night's Watch with Benjen? Because honestly, I think Benjen, for being such a highborn person joining the Night's Watch, my headcanon tends to be that he was so, you know, disgusted with everything of losing, again, nearly practically all of his family, is like, screw this, I don't have to be Lord, you do, I'm going to the Night's Watch.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that's exactly what happened, and I think that's what, you know, the same thing happens with John here, that, you know, John's like, well, I don't want to father any bastards. Like, no one's going to take me, and I'm not going to have any, you know, castles to run. So I just want to go to Night's Watch and have a purpose. And I think that's what Benjen thought. And I think as well, that Ned has that vibe that he would just like, I want to have a higher purpose than just marrying and be someone's banner man if Brandon didn't die.
Yeah, it's so sad. To John, it makes me so sad. This little 14-year-old boy feels so disconnected that he cannot achieve anything in the world, and that the best option for him is to go join Night's Watch, especially since it's already kind of established that, again, the Night's Watch has been declining in prestige for some time. But still, like, there's nothing else John can think of to do.
And actually... Yeah, sorry, he glamorizes it. He sits in bed at night. Like, he lays in bed at night thinking of, like, fantasizing of going off to the Night's Watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I hate Catelyn much.
Me too. Yay! Let's do a Hate Catelyn fan club. Like, we'll make badges.
And then, let's see... What else did I say in my note? So it got to the point where, you know, John is trying to push Benjen to, like, you know, tell my dad I want to join the Night's Watch. He'll let me if you say so. Mm-hmm. And Benjen, I don't think he's trying to be insensitive or tactless. But I think, again, because Benjen is the youngest son, but he's still trueborn. And again, because he's not around, he's not around to see how probably Catelyn penalizes John in a variety of ways. And so not being very thoughtless of using the term bastards or like come back when you fathered a few bastards. And John is so, you know, he's so out of touch with John's experience as a bastard to the sense of like, I will never, ever, ever father a bastard because I will never have a kid that has to grow up the way I did.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Yeah. And he was lucky enough to actually end up in a highborn.
Like, again, that's house. The sad thing. For being a bastard, he is at the best he could get mm-hmm. where he's more or less being raised alongside his siblings and his father is nice to him, mm-hmm. but still.
Yeah. If you think about, like, Robert's bastards, like, so many of them just... Robert just leaves them there. Obviously, that's not here yet, so let's not talk about much about it. But, you know, yeah. if you think about it, there's a lot of other people in worse positions than he is. And I think he knows that. I think he recognizes it, that even though he mm-hmm. has been mistreated in that house, he doesn't get mistreated by everyone. It's just Catelyn. So he still has a good position, but, like, no one else would have that. And he doesn't want that. He just wants to... you know, go off and help out, and like he doesn't care that he's still a virgin and hasn't you know, experienced life. He just thinks like, that's my purpose.
Yeah, well, and again, I can't fit it in this life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So
that's the whole point.
Yeah, and I think Benjamin is just being condescending. It's just like, if this boy thinks he knows what he wants, like, just let him go and let him see how it is, because like, they do have to train a little bit, don't they, mm-hmm. before they take the oath. So let him go, let him see what it is for himself, and then if he fancies it, just, you know, I don't think people give enough credit to kids when they say that they want something.
Benjen, I think, obviously is right in, you know, obviously the hardships of the Night's Watch, but again, being very callous of, you know, again, the reasoning behind it is, you know, whether it's necessarily right for him to go to the Night's Watch or what, but, you know, should be thinking about, oh crap, he feels so disconnected from his family and everything that this seems like a good option. Yeah, he's romanticizing mm-hmm. it, but even still, this, you know, that's usually not, I should talk to Ned about that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But that's not, and so he runs out after that little like confrontation with Benjen, and bumps into Tyrion Lannister.
He's sitting there like a gargoyle. That's what Jon describes him, like a gargoyle, and like strikes up conversation with him, which I don't think a lot of people would do anyway, knowing that Jon is a bastard.
Tyrion's like, "You're Ned Stark's bastards. Like, Lord Stark is my father, and Lady Catelyn is not your mother."
Yeah.
So, and gives Jon the piece of advice, you know, wear those like badges, like honor, so that they'll never hurt you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he goes into the like, how would you know about being a bastard? And like, you know, all dwarves are bastards in your father's eyes. And it's like, you're the son of Tywin Lannisters. And he's like, am I?
No.
And there's nothing to, I don't think really yet, to suggest this, although it is a theory out there. I kind of like the idea that Tyrion is a Targaryen, like, because I wouldn't necessarily want Joanna Lannister to have been like assaulted, but just the idea that he's not Tywin Lannister's kid, and that he's Mad mm-hmm. King's Aerys kid, and therefore is Daenerys's half brother and one of the three heads of the dragon.
Yeah, that would have been amazing. That would have been amazing if that came through. Well, you never know. There's still, you know, two more books to come out. So
theoretically.
Something. Yeah, theoretically. One day, maybe, you know, before we are old and can't read anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, hopefully that will come out. But it's interesting how Jon accepts himself, and, you know, he calls himself bastard. He's like, oh, yeah, I enjoy sometimes being a bastard because I can do this, this, and this without, you know, repercussions. But then when other people say it, he doesn't like it.
Yeah. It's so, like, no one can say that but me.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Yep. And then I love this last line of the chapter. Mm-hmm. Where is it? And with that, he turned and sauntered back into the feast, whistling a tune. When he opened the door, the light from within threw his shadow clear across the yard. And for just a moment, Tyrion Lannister stood as tall as a king.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just shows how quickly he changed his tune about Tyrion, like in the beginning of the chapter when they were all coming in, and he's just like, you know, all the beauty went to his brother and his sister, and he's just like all this like weird, disfigured person. And it's like, even though like John, it described that John stared at him in fascination, but sort of like he was a thing and not an actual human. And then like after having this conversation, John's like, oh, this is actually a cool guy.
Yeah, well, I think John understands Tyrion's point of having any sort of disability, whether social or physical, any sort of othering is going to dispossess you in regards mm-hmm. to this very rigid, not very enlightened society.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just, yeah, anything can put you, can be a castaway. Castaway? Yeah. So he understands, and I think that's what made him a bit more human to John.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, it's the question of, you know, going through hardships like makes you a better or more empathetic person, which is true in some mm-hmm. in some regards. It's true of my husband. You know, it's true of both Tyrion and John.
Mm-hmm.
It widens their capacity for humanity. But there are some people I've met where going through hardships just made them really shitty people.
Mm-hmm. I have met one person like that, actually. I have met one person like that. And I was just like, how? And it's just, yeah, it's a bit sad. But with Tyrion as well, he is sort of in the same position as Jon, just for the fact that, you know, he was born the way that he is, a dwarf. And but then he also was born in a high society, you know, in a castle. So he also understands that people out there would have had it worse, and he understands sort of like
mm-hmm.
that way of being, that way of thinking.
Sense of relativity.
Yeah, exactly.
Alrighty then, and now we move on to our history lessons.
Let me talk to you a little bit about the Starks in Winterfell. Mm-hmm. And the House of Percy.
Ooh, yeah.
Yes. So, let me see if I can say this right. Alnwick Castle in Northumberland, England's most northerly county, was the first line of defense against the wild men from the north, so like the Scots. And it controlled the only passable road from London to Edinburgh, which still exists. It's called the Great North Road. So it's much like the King's Road that goes all the way from Winterfell mm-hmm. to King's Landing. So in 1314, Alnwick Castle was home to the House of Percy. And they were the leading house of the North. And if the Scots were to come down and wreak havoc, they were in charge of raising the men from the five northern counties to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
And Henry the Percy was recognized as the strongest northern lord of the time. And even though he did have his rivals, he, you know, people very much respected him. The Percys were known as kings in the north as well. And they mm-hmm. were in charge of keeping the peace. So, you know, they in the north, they were... you know, the money came from them, the armies came from them, the laws came from them. So it was just like a whole other country in the north. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that I'm glad you chose that one, because I've been reading Shakespeare and Henry Percy is a character in King Henry IV, parts 1 and 2.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
Yeah, and because it's the idea of, you know, we have... You know, because the first play in chronological order, there's Richard II, and he's deposed by Henry, who becomes like Henry IV. And there's this whole idea that Henry IV's son, who is also Henry, called Harry, and mm-hmm. he's like gallivanting in taverns and stuff with this older guy called Falstaff. And there's been a lot of people who have compared Robert Baratheon to Falstaff,
mm-hmm.
you know, as being this jovial, drunken whatever. And yeah. So part of it is, you know, the real crown prince is, you know, in these taverns with Falstaff, you know, mm-hmm. gaining up to like all sorts of, you know, teenage tirades. But in comparison, Harry Percy is like the model of like the strong, you know, young, you know, eldest son that can, you know, take care of business and things like that. So
yeah.
I've already had a taste of Harry Purse via Shakespeare's interpretation of that time period.
That's amazing. That is really cool. So, you know, the Percys were not only powerful and rich, but they were loved too. And, you know, the northern men would follow them wherever they went. So, you know, the Percys would call. Yeah, exactly. The Bannermen. So I'll end this little lesson on a quote. It says, "To them, the last man standing between the Northerners and destruction was not the faraway king, but a Percy. He was their commander, their protector, their judge, and their sheriff." And just very quick, Alnwick Castle was actually used in Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone and Chamber of Secrets, the outside shots when they're doing, you know, Quidditch.
Yeah, the flying lesson. I know that it was used for Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. So my history lesson comes from the Targaryens, just the fact of the Targaryens, their status as a like exiled royal family. My husband is Persian, and so as some people know, in 1979 there was the Islamic Revolution in Iran, which means that the Shah, the king, you know, basically fled Iran with his family. And so they were, and now, you know, they fled, and the Shah like had cancer, so they were like globe hopping, because again there was this sense of, you know, at first like the Targaryens, like, you know, there were some people and some countries willing to take in the Shah and his and the, you know, deposed royal family, and some weren't, because they didn't know, is like, is the Shah gonna go back and rule Iran, or do we need to ingratiate ourselves with the new regime and distance ourselves from the Shah? So so they were globe hopping trying to figure all that out. And then you know, the Shah unfortunately died a few years later, because he already had cancer. But the queen and the crown prince basically, you know, lived in exile in the West, whether in Paris or in the United States. And and the crown prince continues to be a public figure, you know, in the United States. And my husband has spoken to him a few times.
Because
many of my husband's ideas for Iran align with his, because they wanted to modernize it and want to get rid of this crappy Islamic Republic regime. And again, cyber army of Iran, if you're listening to this, fuck you. Leave my husband's social media alone. Leave us alone. It's getting really tiresome with all the fake Facebook account requests.
Oh, that's so pathetic. Pathetic. Grow up.
They devote an entire cyber army to like try and disrupt the discourse of the Iranian diaspora.
Oh my god. It's not like they have a country to run or anything.
No, just let the people die.
Yeah, just let the people die, and let's just like focus on more important things, which is like people.
And what's so ironic is that my husband will like get on Clubhouse and like have discussions with other Iranians around the world, and it's not just discussions that are about like Iranian opposition and like modern politics and stuff. Like, these cyber agents will go onto my husband's like discussion groups of like classical philosophy, because they can't deal with the fact that, you know, they want to portray all the opposition as, oh, they just go to the West to like drink and have sex and they're not cultured or anything. So like they want to like disrupt any sort of like highbrow discourse of philosophy, and like, you know, don't want people to realize that, oh, the people who are in the opposition are actually really smart.
Oh yeah, that's the only thing that that these kind of people have, is to try and disprove.
So just certainly the Shah and his family has not been the only deposed family, certainly, and not in the modern world is that, but that's just what it made me think of. And the fact that, you know, these, you know, dethroned prince and princesses, you know, do still exist in the world and, you know, try to do what they can politically, even if they're unable to return to their countries in question.
That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, I just know specifically about the Shah and all that because my husband is Persian. It's time for friendship lessons. Thank you.
So my friendship lesson comes from Tyrion.
Of course.
Who is also, like, I do really like him as well. And turn your friends' perceived weaknesses into their strengths. Mm-hmm. And obviously it comes from telling him, you know, know that you're a bastard and use that as your strength. And mm-hmm. don't let it be your weakness, because people know who you are, so don't forget who you are.
That's a good one. Mine also came from Tyrion, because Tyrion was the obvious choice, because mm-hmm. like, certainly wasn't going to get anything substantial out of Viserys or whatever.
Yeah, or the friendship between Ned and Robert, because Ned is just like, okay, yes, your grace, and yeah, you know.
But mine from Tyrion is a little less obvious than, you know, just the turn weaknesses into strengths. Mine is, be careful when trying to show your friend a different perspective. And what I mean by that is, yes, it's good for you to attempt to show your friends, like, another way of looking at something, but mm-hmm. also, by in doing so, also not devaluing, you know, the position and the struggles that they're currently in.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yes, it is possible to, like, get some positive out of this negatives, but there's no denying that all this social infrastructure, that this is a negative and it does suck, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah. Bit sympathetic as well.
Yeah, so just, you know, just make sure that while you're showing a different perspective, also, you know, paying homage to, like, yes, this really sucks, you shouldn't have to be dealing with this anyway, but let us consider mm-hmm. ...
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, Tyrion coming through with all the life lessons. I'm pretty sure it's going to be a recurring theme here, because he's very wise, especially when he says, "I am the god of tits and wine." I love that. I want that on a t-shirt.
I could not brave to put that on a t-shirt. But yeah, thus concludes this episode of Podcasters Landing. Tune in next time, where we'll be going over our first chapter with Arya, and then Bran, and then first one with Tyrion.
Yay, Tyrion!
Catch you guys later. Bye!
Bye!
Thank you for listening to Podcasters Landing. The music to our intro is copyrighted by Persian-German composer Ramin Djawadi. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophia Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophia Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophia Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophiaMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophia Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophiaMareStudios. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks. That was the Sophia Mare Studios podcast.